session number 25452, Reel 1.
Major Littleton, Reel 1.
Can you tell me if there is any tradition of military service in your family background?
Very little. In the First World War, I had an uncle who served with machine guns, and also was a dispatch rider. He got an MC. He was quite amazed with that, I think, because he was happily doing his job at the time, and a lot of Germans suddenly appeared in sight, and he shot them. And for that he got an MC. But apart from that, I don't think I've any relatives on my own side directly who were military people.
When you were growing up, did you do any military or pre-military training when you were at school, for example, or out of hours?
Ah, well, that's I was very left-wing when I grew up. In fact, I was in my teens, and I was first a pacifist, then a member of the CP Communist Party for some years, actively. And when I was at school, at Leeds Grammar School, there was, of course, an OTC, an Officers' Training Corps. And I said, no, not for me. As a result, I never became a prefect, and I really think that it was held against me for some reason, but nothing serious. So that really, once the war came along, everything was very different.
When you were growing up again, 20s and 30s, did you have expectations of war?
Oh yes, indeed, because as a left-winger in that sense, I was a member of the Popular Front at that time, the Left Book Club, which of course bred the Popular Front. I was secretary of the Leeds branch of the Left Book Club in Leeds, and consequently I was pretty heavily involved in anti-fascist activities of all sorts up to 1939. So that really is the best answer I can give you as to what I was doing. And I was very conscious, particularly from Munich onwards, that this Munich was just not going to work, and that Churchill was right in his wilderness years as to what had to happen.
Was that the turning point in the Munich crisis?
Particularly, of course, remember, although I have no religion, by definition I am a Jew. And consequently, that also affected the latter years when the Holocaust and the refugee problem took place in this country.
Do you remember when you were thinking about the future and the prospects of war, whether you felt that it was likely we would be fighting the Italians, or was it always the Germans who were the main potential enemy for you?
Oh, I think very much the Germans. I think because of the background that I've just been talking about, very much the Germans. When it came to operations, of course, the Italians really were very poor soldiers, because I don't think the Italians had their heart in it. It was not an atmosphere of Garibaldi.
So you had political expectations of war. You said that you were a communist up until 1939. What happened in 1939? Did you cease to be a communist?
Yes, I felt that in spite of the fact that Russia was not involved in the war at that stage, nevertheless, my feelings then were that this has come to a crunch, and that irrespective of Communist Party policy at that time, I had to play my part.
Were you affected particularly by the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact of August 39? Did that make a big impact on you?
Only in political terms. It put me off my relationships with the Soviet Union, in political terms.
Did that have a divisive effect on the communists in Leeds, that pact between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany?
difficult to remember, quite frankly, after all this time. Once the war had started or about to start, my activities, as you know, I joined up in September, so I very quickly lost all my associations with previous political people.
Now, when you were contemplating the prospect of a renewal of war in Europe, did you have any ideas about its military characteristics, the way in which it was likely to be fought?
No. I suppose the fact that I hadn't been to OCTU, I had no military background in that sense, I had no idea what was going to happen. I just had to take it as it came along. I had no preconception, except that in most wars one always thinks in terms of the last war. In fact, that was the reason, although I was heavily committed to Vera, who became my wife, many people like me had to make that decision, should you get married, should you not, at the beginning of the war. You think back to what happened in World War II, World War I, huge casualties and so we decided against it. And in fact, I was abroad for 4.5 years and we got married when I came home.
Did the actual outbreak of war come as a surprise to you, the 3rd of September?
Not really. After Munich, it became, the timetable seemed to be me crystal clear.
What happened to you then, September? Were you called up before the outbreak?
No, immediately after the outbreak. Practically, I went to Russia for a holiday in 1939, just before war started. In fact, I came back by sea. I think I was about the last ship to come back through the Kiel Canal before it closed. It was as close as that. But at no time did I expect there to be peace with honour or what have you.
Where did you go when you went on that holiday to Russia?
Moscow and Leningrad. Moscow and Leningrad. It was great fun.
Did you see any signs there of preparation for war or
action? No, not at that stage.
This was the time, wasn't it, when they were getting into a state of tension with Finland?
Yes.
Did you see
it doesn't ring any bells with me.
Didn't impinge.
No, it doesn't at all.
What was your civil occupation?
It's a family firm, clothing manufacturers, and Leeds was a huge clothing centre, and it was a firm established by my grandfather, and my father was managing director of it, and I joined the family business after training as what is now called a management accountant. And we had a pretty large factory in Leeds at that time, employing about 600 people. Unfortunately, at the end of 1939, after I had joined the army, it got burnt down. And that was a major tragedy, which really doesn't come into this particular picture.
Got your call up in September. What did you have to do when you got the brown envelope?
Report to Greenhound's depot at Richmond. On whatever date it was, which I did with some trepidation, as you can imagine, and then had to adapt my life accordingly.
What happened to you when you arrived? Could you go through the sequence of...
I suppose I did. That doesn't have much of an impact on me now. What does is the... Well, looking retrospectively at it, that here was I, a sort of middle-income, middle-class boy, young man, suddenly thrown in with every sort, shape, size and type of person, and it did me the world of good, I can promise you.
How did you get on with these other
Well.
What did they do with you in the first weeks when you were doing your basic training?
I think that at that stage it was very much routine, as I remember. Drills, routines, a certain number of lectures on this. The dangers of sexual diseases came into the picture. But really my recollections of Richmond are not very strong. When I started to train as a signaller, then I can remember more about the sort of day-to-day activities.
Do you remember anything about living conditions at Richmond?
Accommodation? Barracks, very good, very good. Maybe 20, I should think, 10, 15 beds a side. Small naffy. Not very. Richmond seemed a nice depot. I had no complaints about it. I was well fed and learnt to eat whatever there was put in front of me. And I became quite quickly acclimatised.
What about your state of physical fitness? Were you a fit man when you joined up?
No, not particularly. I was reasonably fit. I was, fortunately, I'm a thin bugger, and that helps, you know. And particularly it helped in the desert later on, I can assure you. But by the time I finished the training and route marching and this, that and the other, and uphill and down dale, I was a reasonably fit man.
Did you find the discipline a shock to the system?
Not at that stage. Later on, when I was an officer and had to think and appreciate what was happening, I was a bit more rebellious than ever I was over discipline when I was a private soldier and just learning the trade.
Now, when you went off on your specialist training in signals, why did that happen? Did you volunteer for signals training, or were you just
picked
out?
No, they thought I was the sort of bloke who could learn Morse code, and the signals training centre was outside Richmond Depot. It was a place called Ask Hall, about 5 miles away, and we had the stables as our accommodation, and the officers lived in Ask Hall, which was a fairly large family estate of some sort.
Was this just Green Howard's training there?
Purely Green Howard's, purely as a signalman, remember, a private soldier.
So this was regimental
signal officer. But of course the thing that I remember particularly about that is the type of training. You know, we were taught flag and semaphore with flags and heliograph, as if we were in India from mountain top to mountain top. This is the crazy thing about training in those days. It was so, seemed to be so pre or First World War rather than up to date.
Did you ever have occasion to use the heliograph later?
No, I didn't.
Or a flag?
Nor a flag. My Morse code was reasonable because that was used a little bit, but not a great deal really once you've got landlines. The main problem, of course, was radio. Those days, and not only in training but in later, as we may come to, the number 18 set, which was all the ordinary infantry soldier or signaller had, was a great big cumbersome thing that you put on your back, obviously with valves. No transistors had been invented, valves were always breaking, and the thing was very unreliable.
How did they go about actually teaching you how to use it and how to learn the code when you were at the depot and at Ask Hall?
Oh, in detail, I really can't remember. I suppose the main thing was the use of Morse code.
The key,
yes, buzzer, as it was called. And for that you trained steadily up to pass out at whatever level they wanted for an infantry signaller. I don't know, 10, 15, 20 words a minute probably. I'm not quite sure. Later on, when I did a signaller's course at Catterick as an officer, then the standards were much tougher.
You mentioned line communication. What sort of line communication system did you have in those days?
Line communication,
telephone.
Did I?
Did you use field telephone?
Oh, yes, field telephone, certainly. Yes. Fairly simple gadget, connected with a series of wires and cables that kept breaking and had to be mended. So you learned how to splice a cable and things like that for more permanent positions.
Did I mean, did it have an exchange system?
Not that I remember, not even on a battalion. I suppose signal platoons headquarters will have had some sort of an exchange so that one line could talk through it to another if you were meant to be in a location for any given length of time.
How many of you were there being trained in signalling?
Oh, I suppose 20, 25, something like that.
Did they all pass the course?
I can't remember, but I imagine that they will have done. I think it was fairly obvious that you had to have enough about you before you were selected to be a signaller to stand a reasonable chance. They weren't wasting their time or money to pass what was not a very high standard.
And what were you able to do when you weren't actually working? Did they have any particular arrangements for recreation, social life at Ask Hall?
Certainly not at Ask Hall. The most recreation you had was to get to know one or two civil families. I and one or two mates found much hospitality from a nearby farmer and his wife and things. We used to go there for an evening and have a beer with them, and that was about it.
And I think while you were doing your training as a signaller, you were chosen for Octo. How were you selected? Was there a formal sort of test, or was it an informal method?
Do you know, I'm awfully sorry, but I can't even remember. I think I went before somebody or some people, but I really cannot remember. All I know, I was selected.
And then I think your next stage was in the spring of 1940, being sent to Dunbar to Octo.
Yeah.
What was on the syllabus of training at the Octo?
Again, memory is poor. It's incidents, the odd incident here and there. But the detail of training, I really can't remember. A good deal of lectures, a lot of, I suppose, leadership training of one sort or another, the detail of which I can't remember. A fairly tough regime, night exercises and things like that. I always remember my night exercises because they very kindly produced a piper at the end of it. And it was the first time I'd realised the influence on one's morale after you are absolutely exhausted and you fell in behind a pipe. By Jove, you suddenly learnt to march again. It was really extraordinary. I've always remembered things like that. Quite tough training otherwise. I remember being in the swimming pool there, and we were all made to jump off the top board, whether we liked it or not. You didn't have to dive off it, but you could jump off it.
Do you know what that was supposed to do?
Well, I suppose it was to show you got some guts, I imagine.
Test of nerve.
Yeah, I suppose so. But that's the sort of thing that sticks in your mind,
you know. Do you remember anything about that training? What it was that was wearing you out?
Oh, nothing under the intensity of it. After all, Dunbar has got some lovely country to train in behind it. And it was fairly exhausting. It would include map reading. It produced, I suppose, sight positioning and that sort of thing.
Do you remember what level you went up to in the tactical side of the training? Were you up to platoon level or company?
Yes, you would certainly be up. Certainly not company level, except in general terms about how the army worked and what the responsibilities of various levels of command were. But you came out as a competent officer, as a second lieutenant, to command a platoon.
Who was actually mainly employed in instructing you?
Mainly NCOs. And they were very good. Again, the thing that always amused me, remember it, you know, an NCO would take you for drills and, "You bloody man, sir!" At the end of it, it was always "sir," because you were a cadet training unit. And you'd be sworn at in good and true NCO fashion as an instructor, but always "sir" at the end of it.
You have to abuse with respect.
That's right.
What about the living conditions at Dunbar? Were they better?
As I remember, quite good. Quite good. We were in houses, flats, apartments, I think, one way and another. It's a small town, of course, relatively, but they weren't bad.
What about the other cadets at Dunbar? Do you remember anything about them?
Not at all, no, hardly anything. They were a mixed bag of people, and I got on well with everybody, I think. But I have no anecdotal stuff or much of a memory as to the detail of Dunbar.
I think you, this is going on February, May. Now in May, some dramatic events began in Northwest Europe. Do you remember whether you were aware of that or not while you were at Octo?
We were conscious of the war having come to life and the Foley War being over. One was conscious of that, and now we shall be finished our training, and where will we be sent, and what will we be sent to do? But that's all.
And you went, I think, to the 6th Greenhouse, which presumably was a territorial battalion at Blandford.
Where I joined them, yes.
Do you remember anything about them? What state they were in when you joined them? Because they were, in June, have been just back from France.
That's right, and there was much retraining because there was much reinforcement, obviously. There was much retraining, and both Blandford and later on when we moved to Frome in Devon, quite a lot of time was spent going to, to Bristol, who were very heavily bombed, and to clean the place up and try and get food and stores out of warehouses that were bombed and so on. In between time, we just trained and trained and trained.
Do you remember what the content of that training was? What was anything in particular emphasised?
No, not particularly. A lot of training was it was field training essentially. We were out doing exercises, whatever sort of exercises were designed for the purpose. I have no recollection in detail. I was commanding a platoon at that stage, and you did whatever you were told. You were, after all, the lowest of the low, even as an officer.
How were you received then when you arrived at Blandford? What was the sort of reception?
Oh, quite well. As I remember, the officers' mess was a friendly place, and Ted Cook Collis was then in command of 6 Greenhards.
What sort of chap was he?
Well, of course, I was devoted to him. He was a regular soldier, very tough, would not suffer fools gladly, and I think he did a good job, as the whole of my relationships with him during the fighting side of the war and the Desert War will show. I had my ups and downs with him, it is true. But in the end, he was the one man I had enormous respect for.
Do you remember anything about your first platoon? How did they receive you when you arrived as a newly minted officer?
No, I'm memory is not helping me there at all. All I know is that I can't remember any problems. If I can't remember any problems, it must have been a reasonably, and I learnt of course from the people who really matter, from one's corporal and one's platoon sergeant. They're the people that really matter.
I was going to ask you about whether you remembered the sergeant of the platoon.
Not specifically, but I have such a respect for NCOs that if they become platoon sergeants, then they will take a young officer on and they will teach him his trade.
And do you remember if any of the members of the battalion had stories to tell of what had happened to them when they'd been involved in the fighting in France?
No, I don't, quite frankly. I have no recollection of that. That's interesting you put that point. It's never even entered my head. So the answer to that is no. I don't recall anybody reminiscing about it, except in general terms. I've learnt more about it from books than I have from them.
And I think you were also on anti-invasion duties. What was that? Were you near the coast.
Yes, when we had defensive positions and inland as well, at least knowing where to go. Not so much as building things, but where to go, what our function would be, what our parameters were as a battalion or brigade and so on, rather than digging holes or anything like that.
Do you remember if you ever had an alarm, were you ever called out on an invasion alarm? Or
no, I don't think we were. Not that I remember.
If you had to move, how would you have moved? Did you have your motor transport or would you have been on foot?
It depends at that stage whether I was on a motorcycle at some stage. I think it was when I was a signal officer, mind you. That was my vehicle.
Yes.
But apart from that, I suppose we were moved around in a lorry, same as anybody else. You were shoved into a three-tonner and you got onto it and moved. That's about the only transport we have with three-ton lorries, open ones.
So you were training your platoon mainly out in the open, you say field training,
yes.
Presumably tactical training. Do you remember anything about
no.
that at all?
No, sorry.
Then you had the officer's signal school at Cataract. Now, do you know why you were chosen for that?
Well, I suppose because I had signal training as a raw recruit when I, you know, at Ask Hall, that Ted Cook College thought, well, I need a signal officer, or I need one that's got him. If I send him to Catterick on a course, and with the background he's got, he should come back reasonably competent. So I think that was the reason why I was sent there, because he could do with a signal officer in due course.
What was the course at Catterick then? How did it differ from the one you'd done earlier when you were?
Oh, much more intensive, of course. Much more. I don't think it was a long course. You had to pass in on buzzer at a given speeds. And you had to pass out at the end of the course, and if you didn't pass in at the right speeds, you had to go and practice and take it again and again until you did. Apart from that, you got a better training in field communications, such as landlines chiefly, and of course use of wireless, the famous 18 set that I've mentioned before.
Did they teach you about the innards of the wireless? Technology, or was it all still practice?
Oh yes, it was all practice. And you could do simple repairs, but nothing else like that. I wouldn't know. And you knew which valve fitted in which hole, and you could test to find out which valve was sort of bust or something like that. But nothing highly technical. No time involved for that.
But were you trained to be an instructor, so that you could train up signalers?
Yes, that you had to do, because if the resultant posting when you went back to your unit was to become a signal officer, you probably had to start with at least a proportion of people to grow your platoon into something that was competent. So you had to be able to do basic instruction.
And on the Cataract course, were they still using things like flag and lamp and helio, or were they given up for the officers' course?
I'm not too sure of this. I have a feeling that we were still involved with their use, but I don't think to any major extent, and I wouldn't swear that to be a fact.
When you came back to the battalion as the signals officer, regimental signals officer, what was the state of the signals platoon? Was it up to strength? And was it trained?
No, it was largely untrained, and I did work hard at it. It fascinated me. It was something as distinct from just running an infantry platoon, it was something that gave me a bit of scope and things, and I enjoyed it. And I think I trained it up pretty well. It seemed to be doing its stuff there. As I say, at that time my vehicle was a motorcycle, which I hated, but nevertheless that was it. They hadn't invented jeeps. And the platoon gradually became a cohesive unit.
What was the strength of the signals platoon?
Can't remember. It wasn't 30 people like an infantry platoon.